Welcome to the Poplar Forest Archaeology Podcast. I'm Jack Gary, Director of Archaeology and Landscapes. This eight-part series, narrated by Dick Heiner, is designed to walk you through the process of archaeological research at Thomas Jefferson's retreat home and plantation in Bedford County, Virginia. This audio documentary is made possible by a grant from the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services and funding from the Corporation for Thomas Jefferson's Poplar Forest.
To understand the archaeological sites at Poplar Forest, such as Site B, it is important to know the property's history. Much of this history comes from historic documents such as personal letters, memoranda, and maps. Poplar Forest archaeologists benefit from the fact that Thomas Jefferson wrote more letters and notes than most other people living in the 1800s. However, even Jefferson didn't write down everything. For example, he didn't record the exact locations of Poplar Forest slave quarters, stables, or gardens. Still, he did leave important clues in his documents, and one of the archaeologist's first jobs is to pull these clues together to create a history of the plantation. Poplar Forest's history began in the mid-1700s, with land becoming exhausted by the overproduction of tobacco. Land speculators from the coast began pushing into the more fertile western reaches of Virginia by the 1740s. These planters saw the rolling hills of the Piedmont as an opportunity to continue accumulating the wealth they had made growing tobacco in the Tidewater. William Stith of Williamsburg was among those wealthy men, and in 1749 he patented a 4,000-acre tract known as Poplar Forest. Covered in groves of tulip poplar trees, this land remained untouched for several years until John Wales, a lawyer and land speculator, purchased the property in 1764. Soon, the first enslaved African-American laborers were living at Poplar Forest, where they cleared small plots of land for tobacco cultivation. After Wales' death in 1773, his daughter Martha and son-in-law Thomas Jefferson inherited the plantation. Jefferson saw this inheritance as an opportunity to raise tobacco and wheat for sale and hopefully make enough money to pay off some of his debts. Soon Poplar Forest had several families of enslaved laborers working and living on the plantation under the supervision of overseers. These enslaved workers lived in small cabins clustered in fields or near the overseer's house. Soon after receiving Poplar Forest, Jefferson's life of public service began in earnest, as he served as the Governor of Virginia, the Minister to France, the Secretary of State under George Washington, and Vice President for John Adams, and finally as our third President. Jefferson was unable to devote the time to Poplar Forest plantation operations that he would have liked. However, he began to contemplate using a section of his Bedford County lands for a new purpose. By his second term as President in 1806, he began to construct a private retreat house amidst the agricultural fields of his plantation. By 1809, just as Jefferson was leaving the presidency, the first incarnation of his retreat home was completed. Numerous landscaping events, which are noted in personal letters and memoranda, show Jefferson had a wide variety of trees and ornamental vegetation planted around his home at this time. By 1812, Jefferson enclosed a 61-acre section of the retreat with a split-rail fence, setting off this core area from the rest of the agricultural operation. This area, referred to as the curtilage, contained the orchards, gardens, and buildings needed to support the main house. At the time the curtilage fence was constructed, a quarter, where several families of enslaved workers lived, was abandoned because it was in the path of the new fence. Historic documents also indicate that a nursery and large garden were established within the curtilage in order to support Jefferson's vision for his new retirement retreat. Jefferson kept notes that recorded some of the plants growing in the nursery. Based on these notes, large numbers of young trees and shrubs, such as willows, poplars, mulberries, and calycanthus, grew here. Jack Gary, Director of Archaeology and Landscapes, wonders where this operation took place.
Based on the numbers of trees Jefferson noted, the nursery would not have been a small operation. Unfortunately, he never wrote down where exactly it was located. However, it was mentioned in at least two letters as being behind the stable. Another letter suggests it was associated with the large vegetable garden, which, according to documents, is also near the stable. But unfortunately, Jefferson never describes the location of the stable or vegetable garden either. So while the documents never give precise locations of all of these different elements, they do suggest that they all stood together, probably as a whole complex of areas that benefited from proximity to each other. There is also mention in an 1818 letter that two enslaved women named Maria and Hannah each had a house along the garden fence as well. So the picture we're beginning to get from the documents is of a large area within the curtilage with numerous buildings, fences, gardens, and people. You'd think that would be easy to find.
However, Poplar Forest underwent numerous changes after Jefferson's death in 1826 and the sale of the property to William Cobbs in 1828. Buildings, gardens, and ornamental landscapes were abandoned, altered, or torn down to suit the new owner's needs. Many areas were used as agricultural fields and plowed many times, erasing any above-ground evidence of what had happened there in the past. The challenge for Poplar Forest archaeologists is to make the history of Thomas Jefferson's plantation and retreat come to life again. Sometimes the first step is actually finding the site.